So now you can demonstrate that you have spent spring break studying the chapter and a half that we've already been through. So don't look at your notes. Just answer some basic questions. What is the overall process we're looking at in this chapter? The complete oxidation of glucose, right? Glucose is the master fuel. And what kind of reaction extracts energy from fuels? A combustion reaction, which requires oxygen, right? Well, we didn't have any oxygen in the that was required in this first part of the overall process. What is the first part of the complete oxidation of glucose? What is part one? Glycolysis, exactly, which has how many steps? 10 steps. That's where we left off. We studied glycolysis. And oxygen was not required for that part. Oxygen is required for the second part. What is the second part of the overall process? Cellular respiration. And that's where we're at right now in the overall process when we starting slide 14. Well, we can see pyruvate here. What is pyruvate? It's the final product of what? Of glycolysis. So it is just what is left of what was originally glucose. Glucose is fuel, of course, but it's not the only fuel. As glucose gets turned into other things in glycolysis that we talked about, those things are still fuel themselves. But think about what glycolysis has accomplished. We've partly spent the fuel because we've done part of what has to be done in order to get as much fuel as we can out of the glucose. To get as much fuel or energy as we can out of a fuel, we need to completely dismantle the carbon skeleton and we need to pick off all of the hydrogens. Well, we've partially dismantled the carbon skeleton because we started with 1 6-carbon glucose. And after the 10 steps of glycolysis, we have 2, not just this one, we have 2 3-carbon pyruvates. So that's a partial dismantling. And we got some energy out of it. And we've also picked off some of the hydrogens, but not all of them. That's why the 2 pyruvates that we have that glycolysis has spit out is still fuel. It's still valuable stuff. It has a multi-carbon skeleton, pyruvate does, and it has hydrogens on it. So we can still pick off hydrogens, we can still dismantle the skeleton. In other words, we can extract more energy out of it. Well, a cell, to remain alive, has to undergo glycolysis. And so all cells do that. If a cell only undergoes glycolysis, as far as its fuel is concerned, then it makes just a little bit of energy in the form of ATP, which you should think of as the goal for this overall process. The overall goal is to maximize the number of ATPs. Well, we've only gotten a couple, right? We made 4, but we spent 2 to get those 4 for each glucose. So that's not a big payoff. The second part of the overall process is a much bigger payoff. So cellular respiration is definitely worth doing if the cell is capable of doing it. And cellular respiration was invented long before there was any such thing as a eukaryotic cell. And I explained that mitochondria, which are the organelles of cellular respiration in eukaryotes, started out as aerobic bacteria that were engulfed and survived, right? That's how they came to be. But bacteria invented the process we're about to look at in these next slides, the cellular respiration. And that allows for much more efficient use of the energy that was originally in glucose, but now is in three forms. Keep in mind, we've lost some energy along the way. Every step, we lose a little energy, right, because of the second law of thermodynamics. There's no way around that. Can't break the law. But there's three ways that we have, there's three forms of energy that we have at this point. By which I mean at the end of glycolysis. What are the three forms of energy remaining? Meaning that haven't been wasted as heat. ATP, which is the goal. So all of the ATP that was made in glycolysis, that's just part of the goal. It doesn't need to be processed anymore. What are the other two forms? Right. NADH, NH plus, which is which version of that coenzyme? What are your two choices? What two versions do you describe a coenzyme as that it goes back and forth between? Reduced and oxidized. So which of them is NADH and H plus? Reduced. We oxidize our fuels. And by oxidize them, by stripping them of those hydrogens, we're removing energy from the fuel. And we're investing the coenzyme, the taxi, with energy that was in the fuel. So the reduced coenzyme is a second source of energy that was originally in glucose. It's carrying a lot of energy. A single taxi is carrying enough energy to eventually use that energy to make multiple ATPs. So a single NADH is worth more in terms of energy than a single ATP. But we just remember that glycolysis produced not only ATP, but reduced coenzymes, NADH, as well. So that's the second. What's the third form of energy that remains? What is it? FAD? No, we haven't made any FAD yet. I'm talking about in glycolysis. What's the remaining source of energy that's still available that hasn't been wasted? Yeah, the fuel itself, pyruvate. So that's where the energy is. There's no more glucose, but there's three sources of energy, one of which is the goal, so that's already done. One of which is reduced coenzymes that we'll see eventually in the studying the cellular respiration will be able to deliver that energy for the purpose of producing a lot more ATP, which is the goal. And then the fuel itself, the remaining fuel, this partially spent fuel in the form of pyruvate. That's what cellular respiration is all about. Using up the rest of the fuel, or what remains of the fuel, and maximizing the output of ATP. So, we're looking here in slide 14 at a schematic representation of part one of cellular respiration. Cellular respiration in the overall scheme is already part two, right? But cellular respiration has three parts to it. What is the first part? Don't tell me you just relaxed during spring break. The first part of cellular respiration is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. And so it tells you exactly what happens. The name is important. It involves pyruvate, naturally enough, because pyruvate is the starting point since it's the ending point of part one, glycolysis. Pyruvate is out here in the cytosol because that's where glycolysis takes place, remember. Cellular respiration takes place in a mitochondrion. So the very first part of cellular respiration, which is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, does some important things that I'm going to describe here, but it also accomplishes the importation of pyruvate into the mitochondrion. That's what the white arrow represents. These two shades of orange represent the double membrane and the intermembrane space of the mitochondrion. Pyruvate has to cross both of those membranes and get into this full interior, this yellow background. What is the fluid that fills the inner mitochondrial membrane called? Yes, the mitochondrial matrix. That's what this big yellow background represents. And that's where this is taking place. Okay, so it brings, the fuel is brought in, but consider what the rest of the phrase is. It's the oxidative decarboxylation. Well, decarboxylation simply means removal of carboxyl, right? Just like dephosphorylation means removal of phosphate, and dehydrogenation means removal of hydrogen. That's what we've done in glycolysis. We dehydrogenated the fuel partially. Okay, so look at pyruvate. They have it drawn this way to make sense of decarboxylation. It has three carbons overall, but notice that one of these with the dark background is a carbon double bonded to an oxygen and also bonded to what would be an OH at a different pH. The proton was here, but at physiological pHs, the proton goes off on its own. So this, think of this as an OH, and what functional group is that? It's a carboxyl, right? So if you remove that, that's decarboxylation. And the reason it's called oxidative decarboxylation is that in the process of doing that decarboxylation, there's a redox reaction that takes place. So something gets oxidized, something gets reduced. What would you guess gets oxidized? Well, what have we been oxidizing in this overall process? The fuel in general. And right now, what's left of the fuel is the pyruvate. So get used to that. You oxidize the fuels, and you reduce the coenzymes, which are carrying the energy in the form of those electrons and protons extracted from the fuel when you oxidize the fuel. Okay, so notice that CO2 is coming off of here. CO2 is the carboxyl group, a carbon and two oxygens. All right? Now, there's one CO2 that's produced for each pyruvate, but keep in mind, in terms of per glucose, we have two pyruvates doing the same thing independently. So that means this first step of cellular respiration, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, is producing two CO2s of the six that eventually get produced if you completely dismantle and dehydrogenate the fuel. Right? You're going to end up with six one-carbon CO2s with no hydrogen in them. CO2 is completely spent fuel. So when you remove the CO2 by decarboxylation, you have something that left that contains two carbons still and some hydrogen. So it's still valuable fuel. Well, that two-carbon compound, ignore the SCOA here. If you just look at what's the two magenta C's in there, in these oxygen and hydrogens, that by itself is an acetyl group. And so the acetyl group is what is left of the fuel that was originally glucose after pyruvate has been decarboxylated. And that is you can still dismantle it, you can still dehydrogenate it, that's why it's still valuable. In the process, though, of stripping that carboxyl, notice that a redox reaction occurs so that NAD+, an oxidized empty taxi, picks up, as we've already been talking about, just like in the other cases, two electrons and two protons and become the reduced form, NADH and H+. This is another very valuable thing. You made some in glycolysis, you're making more reduced coenzyme in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Everyone on board with all this? Okay. Unlike glycolysis, which did also produce NADH and H+, there is no ATP produced in this step. Okay? But like I said, NADH is even more valuable than ATP. It's just not yet, the energy that it's carrying is not yet in the goal form, which is ATP. All right, now back to this acetyl group. It is the fuel. Now, what did I tell you is the job of a coenzyme in general? NAD is what is a coenzyme we've been talking about, but what do coenzymes in general do? Did I say? No, enzymes do. Coenzymes, what have I been comparing NAD to as a coenzyme? A taxi. Coenzymes in general pick things up and drop them off. All right, so now we're going to talk about another coenzyme, which is called coenzyme A. And just this brown part by itself is coenzyme A. The S here is a sulfur atom, which is just part, it's the only atom that's shown. There's a bunch of atoms in it. But the reason the S is put here is because that's the important part of the coenzyme molecule in terms of picking things up and dropping them off. It gets connected to the S. So an empty coenzyme A picks up what's left of pyruvate after we decarboxylate it, which is the acetyl group. And therefore, when the acetyl group gets in this taxi, the whole thing, the taxi itself plus the acetyl, is called acetyl coenzyme A. And that is the end of part one of cellular respiration, which is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. It's the job of coenzyme A now to deliver this still valuable fuel, the acetyl group, to the second part of cellular respiration. Anyone remember what the second part is of cellular respiration? It goes by three names. One of which is the Krebs cycle, another of which is the tricarboxylic acid cycle, and another is the citric acid cycle. They all mean exactly the same thing. So that's where we're headed now, and that's where this taxi is headed, so that it can drop off this acetyl group, still has usable energy in it, to that process, to the Krebs cycle. Or I should say citric acid cycle, that's the better word, better phrase. So that brings us to 15. And actually, this is showing you more than the citric acid cycle. Citric acid cycle's here, obviously. But this arrow at the top, and this whole, not more than the arrow, all the stuff around that upper arrow is just a repetition of what we just looked at. This up here is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, part one of cellular respiration. And just for simplicity, all we care about are the carbons in the skeleton. That's why pyruvate is denoted simply as three gray spheres. Yes, the hydrogens and oxygen are there. It's just showing you have a three-carbon compound at the end of glycolysis and at the beginning of cellular respiration. That's pyruvate. But remember, there are two of them because we broke down one glucose into two pyruvates. And in the process of decarboxylation, we also oxidize pyruvate and reduce NAD plus into NADH. The decarboxylation produces CO2, which is waste. Can't get any more energy out of it. That's why we exhale it. The CO2 that you exhale each breath used to be an organic compound in the food that you ate. It's been completely spent, though, as far as energy is concerned. What's left is the acetyl group, which is just denoted as two carbons now, and that gets picked up by coenzyme A and driven to the next process, which is the citric acid cycle. Okay, now this is a very simplified citric acid cycle. We're not looking at many details here, But it shows you the really important things in terms of the fuel and the goal. The citric acid cycle, first of all, is a cycle, obviously, but a cycle is also a biochemical pathway. It's simply that the last reaction of the pathway then feeds the beginning again. It wraps around on itself. And so it'll keep going as long as you keep putting things in at the start-finish line. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But anyway, this is several reactions occurring as a cyclic pathway. And one of the things that the citric acid cycle accomplishes is to oxidize what's left of the fuel. It completes the dismantling of the skeleton. It completes the dehydrogenation, or the oxidation, of the fuel, which means that by the time the citric acid cycle is over, there is nothing left fuel-wise that's usable. Okay, remember, per glucose, up to before citric acid cycle, per glucose we have produced two CO2s, right? Because oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate happens for each of the two pyruvates. That's two CO2s. Well, there's two more CO2s produced per pyruvate, per acetyl that enters the citric acid cycle. So there are two acetyls because there were two pyruvates, and therefore two times two more CO2s is four more CO2s. You've now made all six CO2s. The fuel is totally gone at this point. There is some ATP that's produced in this step, or I shouldn't say step, it's multiple steps, but in this cycle. You see that at the bottom. And by the way, the ATP that's produced in the citric acid cycle is produced the same way as it's produced in glycolysis. Do you remember how that is? What the name of that process is called? It is phosphorylation because you're phosphorylating ADP to produce ATP, but what kind of phosphorylation? Substrate level. Remember that a substrate is carrying the phosphate first, and then by binding to an enzyme, it hands it off to the ADP. That happens down here as well, just with different substrates. Okay, so that's more of our goal. So there's more ATP produced, but not all that much actually in this step. Even though we are now completely out of fuel, there's still a hell of a lot more ATP to be made, but no more fuel to break down. Therefore, there must be a lot more energy in another source, in another form. Well, notice what else is happening here. We have multiple NADs, NAD pluses, reduced into NADH and H plus. So we're making, this really occurs when you look at the detail at different places, but overall there's a few more NADHs made, so we're making more reduced coenzymes in addition to the ATP. And this is the coenzyme that we've been talking about all along, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, right? But here we notice we're the citric acid cycle also reduces a different fleet of taxis. It's like a competing company. They do the same job, but they're different cars. This is flavin adenine dinucleotide, a different coenzyme, but it does the same job. All right. The reason it's flavin instead of nicotinamide is that those are two different nitrogenous bases. Okay. And like when you see riboflavin on a nutrition label, that's where it's used, FAD. And niacin, by the way, is what's used for NAD. But anyway, let's compare the oxidized form. Which of these is the oxidized form of FAD? FAD. But compare that to the oxidized form of NAD, which is NAD+. It's not FAD+. It's FAD without a charge. And therefore, it's able to take both electrons and both protons. All four fit in the taxi. And that's why the reduced form is FADH2, not FADH and H plus. Okay? It's still the same thing that's being picked up, though. Two electrons, two protons, in other words, two hydrogen atoms. All right, now FAD is just like NADH, FADH2 is valuable as well. It can produce multiple ATPs with its energy. It's just, for reasons I'll explain later, not quite as valuable, but it is very much more valuable than ATP. So even though the fuel is gone at this point, there's no more fuel to be spent, and even though we've made only a little bit of ATP via substrate level phosphorylation in glycolysis and here in citric acid cycle, by far most of the still usable energy that was originally in glucose is in the form of reduced coenzymes, multiple NADHs, which are produced in three different places: glycolysis, oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, and citric acid cycle, and reduced coenzymes in the form of FADH2, flavin adenine dinucleotide. Okay, now they pick up passengers at different places, but as we'll see, they're all going to drop them off at the same place, more or less the same place, which is the final part of cellular respiration. Now, keep in mind, there's no more fuel left. But we're not done with the process because the goal is to maximize the production of ATP, not reduced coenzymes. The reduced coenzymes need to be processed, in other words. The energy they're carrying needs to be processed to produce a lot more ATP, even though the fuel is now gone. That's why we have the third part of cellular respiration. And what is overall part three of cellular respiration called? Oxidative phosphorylation, right, which we're not quite there because in slide 16, let's look at the citric acid cycle in a little bit greater detail. Now, I don't need you to memorize all these intermediates, but the intermediates are shown here so that you can see that there are eight steps to this cycle. And like I was saying before, it's a pathway, but the ending product feeds into the beginning, so that's why it's a cycle. Well, it can't do that without adding something here. So at step one here, you can think of as the start-finish line of a race that has laps, right? And notice that this final product, oxaloacetate, is a 1, 2, 3, 4 carbon compound. Notice the C's. And at this start-finish line, it's being oxaloacetate. The four carbons of oxaloacetate are being added to the two carbons of acetyl. Notice that coenzyme A here, which is carrying acetyl, is dropping acetyl off to the citric acid cycle. And the two carbons of the acetyl get added to the four carbons of oxaloacetate to produce citrate, a six-carbon compound, which is kind of backwards when you think about the goal of dismantling the carbon skeleton, right? You're making a more complex carbon skeleton here. But that's because that's the way it has evolved to work. Once you make that, then it can be dismantled along the way. And that's why you have here, in step three, some CO2 produced. There's a decarboxylation step. And again here in step four, another decarboxylation step. So as this keeps churning, the individual CO2s that come off, you can think of as the two carbons that were in the acetyl that coenzyme A is driving to this cycle. Okay, so these are completely spent fuel. There's no more fuel left. But along the way, notice that there's important energetic steps. You reduce NAD plus here. You reduce NAD plus here. You produce some ATP via substrate level phosphorylation here. You reduce FAD here. And you reduce more NAD plus here. Okay, so what we have is a little bit of ATP produced in two different places. and a bunch of very valuable reduced coenzymes, NADH, NH+, and FADH2. Fuel's gone. So that brings us to 17, which allows me to start talking about this third part of cellular respiration, third and final part. You correctly said that part three is called oxidative phosphorylation. That is part three of cellular respiration. So in the hierarchy, it's part three of part two, right? Cellular respiration is overall part two. But part three itself is subdivided into two parts. What are the two components of oxidative phosphorylation? Do you remember from the summary slide? Those two parts of oxidative phosphorylation are called electron transport and chemiosmosis. Well, I'm mentioning those in that order because that's the order in which they occur. And also in slide 17, we're concerning ourselves with only that first part, which is electron transport. What we're looking at here is a double duty picture in a sense. It's a graph for one thing, notice. So it's an unusual symbols to use in a graph, but it is a graph, meaning that the position vertically matters, right? Just like a point on a graph matters, how far up or down it is, that has a certain y value. And notice what the y value is here. Free energy, G. All right? But besides being a graph, this is also kind of a cartoon anatomical diagram. These large purple structures here, the large ones that have Roman numerals, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Those are the four protein complexes that collectively make up what is called an electron transport chain. Now, a lot of books will say the electron transport chain as though there's one. Well, there are quadrillions of them in your body. So this is just one copy of many, many electron transport chains. There are many, many of them just in one mitochondrion. And there are many mitochondria in one cell, and there obviously are many cells in the body. But this is one isolated electron transport chain. And obviously electron transport chains are named for the fact that they perform electron transport, movement of electrons. But the way the electrons move is by being passed from one member to the next, which is quite analogous to a bucket brigade, which is kind of an old-fashioned term. Do you know what I mean by a bucket brigade? Your house catches on fire, you just call the fire department. But a bucket brigade was designed in olden times for when you're out in the country, your barn's burning, the only source of water is the well, and so the neighbors come by and they line up. They don't all just try to carry buckets from the well to the fire individually. Instead, they line up between the well and the fire. The person at the well takes a bucket of water, passes it to the next person, and so on. And then the last person in the chain dumps it on the fire. That's a lot more efficient way. Well, this is what's happening here, except that instead of buckets of water, it's electrons that are being transported. Okay? Now, remember what we talked about on the slide in which I showed you the combustion of methane. Remember with the blue dots representing the electrons? The reason that it was exergonic is because those electrons in the fuel, which were not very close to either of the two nuclei that shared those electrons, got closer to one nucleus. And then therefore went down in energy level, right? Closer to the nucleus means lower energy level. That's why this is diagonally shown here, because that's the graph part of it. As electrons get transported from one member to another, they go down in energy a little bit at a time. G is being decreased. And this is what an earlier slide, I think it was even in the previous chapter, meant when it was comparing what's happening in the cells, which is this, to a multi-step hydroelectric plant. When I said that we don't just release all the energy at once, we release it a little bit at a time in usable chunks, that happens primarily in electron transport. All right? Now, back to this bucket brigade analogy. I said that the first member of the chain, which is a protein complex, complex one, receives electrons, then passes those electrons, doesn't keep them, passes them on to complex two and so on, the next member of the chain. Just based on that description, chemically, what is happening in the electron transport chains? How would you describe that chemically? Well, when the first member passes the electrons to the second member, what is happening to the first member? It's getting oxidized. What's happening to the second member? It's getting reduced. So electron transport chains operate as a series of redox reactions. Happening all in one direction, though, right? And each step along the way releases a little bit of energy because the electrons, by being transported from one member to another, are getting gradually closer and closer to a nucleus. It's a different nucleus, but they're getting closer to it as they get past. So they're going down in energy. All right? Now, of course, as usual, a lot of that energy that's released is wasted as heat. But obviously, we want to harness as much as possible. Okay, well, I'll explain how that happens in a minute. But first, I don't want to forget mentioning where these electrons come from. Well, notice what we have here. Full taxis, reduced coenzymes. NADH, NH+, and FADH2, which were produced at the various places we already talked about earlier in the process, starting with glycolysis. This is the destination. An electron transport chain is where all of these passengers are going to be dropped off for the big payoff. But notice that NADH can drop its passengers off at complex 1, which is at a higher G value. Whereas FADH2, the one that's produced only in the citric acid cycle, can't drop them off onto 1. It has to drop them off to 2, which is a slightly lower G value. That's why FADH2 is slightly less valuable than NADH and H+. Okay, now more about these complexes. The ones that are Roman numeraled, 1, 2, 3, and 4 here, I've already told you they're protein complexes. Well, anatomically, these are embedded, these complexes, in a membrane. What specific membrane am I talking about? Where would these? What membrane would these be embedded in? Well, there's two. The inner mitochondrial membrane, exactly. That's where this whole electron transport chain is. And all of the phospholipids that make up the membrane are there as well. They're just not shown here. All right? These other things that don't have no Roman numerals on them, they are mobile parts of it. So they're moving around more so than the complexes. But the ones that have Roman numerals, complexes 1, 2, 3, and 4, are much bigger, as you see. Three of those four, specifically complex 1, complex 3, and complex 4, but not complex 2, have double duty. All these members have one duty, which is to receive electrons and pass them on. But complexes 1, 3, and 4 also have another really important function, which is that they also function as proton pumps. Now, what should you immediately be thinking when I say pump? Exactly. A pump is a protein acting for active transport, meaning that it's moving something against its gradient, which is exactly the opposite of how that particle wants to move, right? Particles want to move down their gradient. Active transport has to be forced to happen. Well, we've talked about active transport. We've seen some examples of it. And like the proton pump in the plant, where the sucrose was eventually pumped, remember? That involved a proton pump. What powered the proton pump in that case? The plant proton pump. What was the source of energy to power it? You always have to have an external source of energy for any pump.
ATP.
But think about our goal here. Why would we want to use ATP to power these pumps when the goal is to produce ATP? Especially because you're never going to get as much energy out as what's in it originally, since you have to waste some as heat, right? So these are pumps. Definitely they are using energy. They have to in order to pump. But the source is not ATP. What is the source of energy for these pumps? It's right there in front of you.
NADH?
No? Well, I mean, in a sense, it's carrying it. But the source of energy to power these three pumps is the energy that's lost as the electrons get transported. There's a decrease in G along the way. That decrease in G is a release of energy. The energy isn't destroyed, right? It's released. So that's what causes these three complexes, 1, 3, and 4, the biggest ones, to also function as pumps, and specifically proton pumps. All right, now think about what started out in glucose. Glucose was completely dehydrogenated along the way in various steps, right? That's how we got the useful energy out of it. But every hydrogen that was picked off in terms of subatomic particles is an electron and a proton, as we've been talking about. Well, the electrons from those hydrogens are what are being transported through this chain, or along this chain, I should say. And the protons, which is the other part of the hydrogen that was in the glucose, are what are being pumped through these three complexes acting as the pumps. And this whole chain is embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. The directionality of the pumping is that protons are taken from the matrix, which is the fluid inside the inner membrane, pumped through the inner mitochondrial membrane into the intermembrane space, the space between the two membranes. Which means because of the operation of these pumps, which is powered by the transport of electrons, there is a gradient that's being produced. Pumps produce and maintain gradients. All right? But the protons are being concentrated in the intermembrane space. All right. So, the coenzymes drop off their electrons and protons. The electrons get transported along the chain, the protons get pumped. But by unloading the taxis, what's a better chemical word than unloading? What's happening to the taxis, the coenzymes? What is it? They're becoming oxidized. NADH is being oxidized back into NAD+, but an empty taxi. FADH2 is being oxidized back into FAD. So they have lost what was the valuable energy they're carrying. Okay? Now we've already didn't have any fuel left. Now we don't have any reduced coenzymes left because they've all emptied onto the chains. But notice, importantly, that no ATP is produced in this part. So since you have no more fuel and you have no more reduced coenzymes, where does the energy come from to produce more ATP in the step that we're about to look at? Where is the still usable form of energy at this point? Well, what are the pumps doing? What did I just tell you the pumps are doing? No, the electrons being transported from member to member are powering the pumps. What are being pumped are protons. And therefore, what is created? A gradient. What have I told you to always remember about gradients? They are a potential energy source. So the energy that was in glucose originally and was for a while in these reduced coenzymes is now in the form of the proton gradient that's produced by pumping these protons. A gradient can do work for you. Well, that work is going to be the big final payoff. The work is going to be put into producing a lot more ATP molecules using the energy that's in the gradient, because there's no more fuel, there's no more reduced coenzymes. We didn't talk about the end. You know, the person right by the fire has to empty that bucket, not only to put the fire out, but in order to empty his or her hands so he can receive another bucket coming along the way, right? If the last person does not get rid of that bucket, the whole transport of buckets stops, right? Similarly, the last member of the chain has to get rid of the electron it received along the way, upstream of it. Otherwise, the entire chain will fill with electrons and everything will stop, including the pumping of protons, which is really the important part here in terms of storage of energy. Well, there is, in any organism that we say respires or undergoes cellular respiration, this is what's happening, electron transport. This is what makes it respiration, the electron transport chain and the pumping of protons. But in order for this to continue to happen, you have to have an exterior particle that can take the electrons off the hands of the last member in the chain. And depending on the organism, that can be different things. For most respiring organisms, including all animals like us, that exterior particle that will accept the electrons is oxygen. That is almost the only reason that we need oxygen when we breathe. I don't know whether you've thought about why you need... I usually pose the question to not just this course, but in all courses I teach, why do we need oxygen? And usually the answer is because we'll die without it. But that's just another way of saying that we need it. Why do we need it? We need oxygen to serve as the final electron acceptor for the electron transport chains. Otherwise, the chains would fill up and everything would stop. But notice oxygen was not used in any of the parts up to this point. This is the only part it's used. And by the way, why does oxygen serve ideally as an electron acceptor? Because it has a high electronegativity. Notice the huge jump in G here, from here to here. Oxygen will gladly take on those electrons. But it doesn't just take electrons, it takes protons as well, which is why the oxygen that we breathe receives hydrogen, electrons and protons together make hydrogens, from the food we eat to produce water. This is the water that's one of the outputs of the overall process. Okay, so this isn't water that we drank. This is the water that we turn, that we make out of oxygen that we breathe and food that we eat. That if, as long as oxygen is available for us and for all organisms that use oxygen, this will continue. That's just one form of respiration, though. What makes it respiration is electron transport. If you're a respiring organism and you use oxygen as your final electron acceptor, then that specifically is called aerobic respiration, because aerobic means involving oxygen. There are some species, though, that use something else. And those are still respiring organisms. They're still doing all of this. They're just using something else. And therefore, that's called anaerobic respiration. It still accomplishes the same thing, just uses something else. Before I leave this slide, let's think about what would happen without oxygen. Well, I've already said it a little bit. But even though oxygen is not required in glycolysis or the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate or the citric acid cycle, all of that stuff would shut down without oxygen for this reason. No oxygen, the electron transport chains fill up with electrons, right? No more pumping of protons. But when they're filled with electrons, notice what that means with respect to coenzymes. Yes, it's true that the earlier steps don't require oxygen, but they require empty taxis. You can't keep packing things into a taxi that's already full. So in all of those steps that involved the reduction of an oxidized coenzyme into the reduced form, whether NAD plus into NADH and H plus, or in the citric acid cycle, FAD into FADH2, all of those things can't happen unless there's an empty taxi of the right type available for that step. So they're dumping these off not just for the payoff in terms of ATP that's going to be produced. These coenzymes are dropping them off also so that they can become empty again, reoxidized coenzymes, so they can then go drive back and get new passengers from the earlier parts. Well, just like there's so many cars in a fleet of taxis in a city, and if they were all full, there would be no available taxis. That's what would happen if there were no oxygen, right? All of them would continue taking passengers from the fuel, but when they stopped being able to dump them off because the electron transports chains are full, all of the taxis would be unable to pick up more, and all of the earlier steps would come to a halt, including glycolysis. No glycolysis, you're dead. So as we'll see, there's a different way that's a second mechanism instead of cellular respiration that can accomplish the same thing, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. Let's talk about the final payoff now. This is slide 18. And at this point, there is no more fuel, there's no more reduced coenzymes. All there is a proton gradient, other than the ATP that's already produced, which is the goal. Okay, now look where we are. This is a membrane, and this is the same membrane where the electron transport chain was embedded. It's just the chains aren't shown here. This is the phospholipid bilayer of the inner mitochondrial membrane. And the orange is the intermembrane space, as you see. The yellow is the mitochondrial matrix. This is the part inside the inner membrane, or enclosed by the inner membrane. Remember the directionality of the pumps in the chains. Because of the energy released by the transport of electrons down the chains, those three members of the chain pumped protons, but they pumped them specifically by taking them from the matrix pumping them through the membrane into the intermembrane space. So there's a very high concentration in the intermembrane space, much lower concentration in the matrix. That's the gradient. Well, whenever you have a gradient, you by definition have a tendency for diffusion to occur, right? But the tendency is only one part of the requirements for diffusion. What are the two requirements for diffusion to actually happen? You have to have a gradient. Well, we do, but what's the other requirement?
Semipermeable membrane?
Well, no, you're thinking of osmosis. The other requirement's a little more general than that. You have to have a way to get from A to B, right? So the gradient is the tendency. That makes the protons, in this case, which is what the gradient is, the gradient makes the protons want to diffuse back into the matrix. And they don't care how they get there. They just want to go down their gradient. But even though there is all kinds of membrane area here, because remember that inner mitochondrial membrane is highly folded into Christi, there's a lot of membrane. Even though there's plenty of places where they could go through, they're unable to. Why is a proton unable to go directly through the phospholipid bilayer of the inner mitochondrial membrane? Right, it's plenty small, right? That's one requirement to get through the phospholipid bilayer. It's small enough, definitely. It's even smaller than an atom. But it's fully charged. It's an ion. So it doesn't want to be around those tails. And therefore, even though they're lining up, in a sense, trying to get through the membrane, they can't. And a mitochondrion is set up in such a way that there's only one type of place. There's many copies of this thing that we're looking at. There's millions of these, though. They're all the same, though. And each one of these is kind of like a turnstile. It's the only place where the crowd can get into the arena is through the turnstiles. Well, the only place that these protons are able to go down their gradient from the intermembrane space to the matrix is through this large protein complex, which is really a molecular machine because it moves. All right? And this overall two purple-colored molecular machine that we're looking at is called ATP synthase. What does the name right away tell you that it is? An enzyme. Has the A-S-E in it. Syn means together. To synthesize means to bring two things together. ATP is being produced by ATP synthase, but the two things that are being brought together or synthesized are ADP and inorganic phosphate. All right? When you bring those two together, hook them together, you make ATP. But notice that it's inorganic phosphate. It's not phosphate that at first is already bound to a substrate like it was earlier. And that's why this is not substrate level phosphorylation. This is oxidative phosphorylation. Okay? Now let's look at the anatomy of the ATP synthase molecule. It's actually many molecules. It's a huge complex of proteins. But there's two major parts to the machine, the stator and the rotor. Same names in a motor, right? A motor has a stator and a rotor. The rotor is the thing that rotates. The stator is static. It does not move. So the rotor rotates with respect to the stator. In an electric motor, you're using electricity to cause the rotation. In a generator, which is really the same thing in reverse, you are forcing movement to generate electricity. Well, that's not what's happening here, but instead, the rotor not only is able to rotate, but notice the part that is embedded in the phospholipid bilayer is attached by a rod to this complex of catalytic knobs. Each of these knobs is catalytic. In other words, each of these knobs is an enzyme. It's a catalyst. Okay? Unlike enzymes we've talked about before, each of these catalytic knobs will operate as a catalyst, will work as an enzyme, in other words, only if it's deformed, only if it gets deformed. Which is kind of like when we activated the enzyme in a previous slide by hooking something onto it, remember? Allosteric activation. Here, what properly deforms the catalytic knob is that if it's moving with respect to the stator. If it's not moving, it won't have the right shape to be able to bring inorganic phosphate and ADP together. But if it is turning, it will get properly deformed, and that will bring the two together to form ATP. In other words, ATP can be produced in this manner only if this thing is spinning. Well, notice what's making it spin. This is the only place in the mitochondrion where these protons that are trying to get from their high concentration intermembrane space to their low concentration matrix, it's the only place they can get through the membrane to diffuse. So the protons are diffusing. That's passive transport, right? They've already been pumped. That's why the gradient is energy. Now we're using that energy by allowing the protons to diffuse back into the matrix. And when they do, it's really analogous to water falling on a water wheel down its gravitational gradient, right? Water falls, that will spin the water wheel, which can grind your corn. In this case, though, the protons diffusing down their gradient turns this rotor with respect to the stator, and that properly deforms these catalytic knobs over and over. Each time that happens, an inorganic phosphate gets added to an adenosine diphosphate to produce adenosine triphosphate, ATP. So it's phosphorylation, but a different way compared to substrate level. The reason it's called oxidative phosphorylation is because you can't have this without the previous part, which was the electron transport, which is a series of redox reactions. So that's the oxidative part of it. Well, not only does this produce ATP, which is, even though it's made a different way, this ATP is identical to the ATP that's produced in the earlier parts by substrate level phosphorylation. It's just more of the goal. But a hell of a lot more of the goal. Roughly 95% of the ATP that's produced if you maximally use glucose, which is what we're doing in the complete oxidation of glucose, is produced in this final step. And this final step, by the way, that we're looking at right here, the use of this molecular machine, is part two of part three of part two. What I mean by that is the overall process is complete oxidation of glucose. Part two of that is cellular respiration. Part three of that is oxidative phosphorylation. Part two of that is chemiosmosis. So electron transport chain, or the electron transport process, allows this to happen because it produces the gradient that this relies on. Just like when I described secondary active transport to you, that example used ATP to pump protons, establishing a gradient that could then pay off in terms of transporting sucrose into the cell by secondary active transport. Here we're using the proton gradient for a completely different purpose, but it's still the same process. It's the gradient is a form of potential energy that has the big payoff. All right. Let's put that together now in slide 19. By that I mean this is the complete oxidative phosphorylation two-part step. So we're looking at just the third part of cellular respiration here, oxidative phosphorylation, but And we're showing only one copy of each of these two players. This is one electron transport chain. This is one ATP synthase. But there are millions of them in each mitochondrion doing the same thing. But we can see now with the arrows what's happening that I described in just words before. All of these reduced coenzymes, NADH and H+, from glycolysis and from oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate and from citric acid cycle, and FADH2 from the citric acid cycle, are driving to the same place, the electron transport chain. Their NAD is dropping them off at 1, FADH2 is dropping off at Q, which is, I mean, at 2, which leads to Q. Q is a carrier between 1 and 3. Okay, so that reoxidizes the coenzymes. These traxies are now available to drive back to the earlier parts and allow those things to continue to happen. Importantly, right? The electrons get transported. That releases energy, which some of which is wasted as heat, but some of which is harnessed to allow members 1, 3, and 4 to operate as pumps for protons, taking them from the matrix, pumping them into the intermembrane space, creating the gradient. Protons want to get back into the matrix, but the only places they can are the many copies of ATP synthase. And when they go through that, that spins the rotor with respect to the stator, causing chemiosmosis, which involves the actual phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. Well, that's the whole process now. We've gone through the entire complete oxidation of glucose. That's the overall process. This summary brings the entire process together, and it's very similar to a summary slide we started with, right? There's just a little bit more detail in this one. The overall process, complete oxidation of glucose, happens in two steps with a particular order. The first is glycolysis, which happens out in the cytosol. It has 10 steps to it, not shown here, but what it takes in as inputs are oxidized coenzymes in the form of NADH, the fuel itself, which is the glucose, and ADP. All right? What comes out after these 10 steps are what is remaining of the fuel, 2 pyruvates, also some reduced coenzymes. The oxidized coenzymes that went in got reduced. So NADH and H+ is an output, and a couple ATP are produced by oxidative phosphorylation. And so the ADP that was the input comes out as ATP. All right, what's remaining of the fuel then goes through, if it can, the process of cellular respiration, which has 3 parts to it. This first white arrow here represents the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate that not only imports the fuel, the pyruvate, into the mitochondrion, which is where cellular respiration takes place. It also, along the way, decarboxylates it, and that's why some CO2 is released that's not shown here, leaving still valuable 2-carbon acetyl that gets picked up by coenzyme A in the form of acetyl coenzyme A. And in that process, no ATP is produced, but more NAD+ is reduced into NADH and H+. Okay, then you have the citric acid cycle, which deals with breaking down what's left of the fuel. Coenzyme A drops the 2 acetyls off, and by churning through these reactions, 4 more CO2s come when you process both acetyls. And that completes the breakdown of the fuel, the dismantling and the dehydrogenation of the fuel. It's nothing but CO2 left, which is worthless. Some ATP gets produced in this part as well, also through oxidative phosphorylation like in glycolysis. But a lot more reduced coenzyme is produced in the form of both NADH and H+ and FADH2. All of these taxis now drive to the same place. The electron transport chains drop them off. The transport of electrons releases energy, causing the pumping of protons through the inner mitochondrial membrane. The protons are being pumped from the matrix to the intermembrane space through this membrane. So they want to get back. The only place they can are the many copies of the ATP synthases, spins them, and by oxidative phosphorylation, a lot more ATP is produced. Now, where do the protons come from that are being pumped? Originally, where do they come from? From glucose, right. From the food that you eat. That's the protons that get pumped. They are just half, each proton is half of a hydrogen that got stripped from the fuel. And the electrons are the other half. And those electrons and protons, after they've done their job along the way, not necessarily the same two, but an electron and a proton, both of which came from the glucose, get reunited as a hydrogen atom along with another electron and proton as another hydrogen atom that get added to one of the oxygens in the oxygen molecule that you breathe to produce a water. All right? So chemically, what's happening to oxygen in this process? In any combustion, if you did this in one step, what happens to oxygen in a combustion reaction? Well, what happens to the fuel?
It oxidizes.
Okay, so what happens to the other thing in the reaction? It gets reduced. Oxygen gets reduced into water, and fuel gets oxidized into carbon dioxide. Just like in the methane example that I showed you on that slide, only using a different fuel. But even though it's a different fuel, you have the same exact, if it's a carbon-containing organic fuel, you have the same two products as if it's just methane. You have oxygen, you have water produced and you have CO2 produced. Okay, 21. Hopefully I can give you at least the high points of this, if not finish it. But I earlier said that without oxygen, everything before electron transport would shut down, even though only electron transport requires oxygen directly. And remember, I said that that's because all the taxis would fill up. If you have only reduced coenzymes, none of the earlier part can work, including glycolysis. And without glycolysis, the cell dies. So there has to be a way other than cellular respiration to reoxidize coenzymes. Cellular respiration, among other things that we've been talking about, also has the important effect of reoxidizing coenzymes. It empties the taxis so that they can continue going back to the earlier processes, including glycolysis, and allowing it to happen over and over, keeping the cell alive. Okay? If you can't have that cellular respiration happening, because oxygen is not available, for instance, then there has to be another way for these coenzymes to be reoxidized so that they'll be available for glycolysis. And that's what we're looking at here. There's many versions of this that have evolved, two of which are shown here, but the overall alternative process that has evolved is called fermentation. Now, fermentation is an anaerobic process, meaning oxygen is not required, but importantly, fermentation is not respiration. So don't think of anaerobic respiration as being another name for fermentation. Even books get this wrong. It's not. It's not respiration at all. Respiration involves electron transport. All right? Well, there's, like I said, multiple versions of fermentation that have evolved. We're looking at two here because these are the two that most humans care about. One is called alcohol fermentation. Another is called lactic acid fermentation. Well, the reason we care about lactic acid fermentation is because this is the kind of fermentation that humans do. So we're interested in that for that reason. And alcohol fermentation, like what happens in yeast, for instance, we care about that because it's so valuable as a process. It's how we make alcohol for various purposes, not just for beer, wine, and booze, but also for all kinds of other things. bread making, cheese making, and so on. But these are not the only two versions. There's all kinds of other fermentation mechanisms. I'm not going to tell you the ins and outs of this because I don't want to be cut short and I'm out of time. I'll just say that what any fermentation mechanism, whatever it is, not just these two, accomplishes is the same. The purpose of fermentation is to re-oxidize NADH and H+ back into NAD+. In other words, to empty the taxi. That's why it has to exist. All right, I'll continue later.